good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And this we go riding in the damp fire.
You're listening to episode 517 of Unwelcome Guests, JFK and the Unspeakable. I'm Robin Upton. This week's show I'm dedicating to Jim Douglas, which is a name that, if you don't know, I venture to say that you should. I'm not a great fan of awards in general, but since he and his wife are recipients of the Parchem in Terris Peace and Freedom Award, I looked it up on Wikipedia. Given annually since 1964, its other recipients include John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and Father Daniel Berrigan, which would make Jim Douglas a figure of potential interest, even if I didn't know how deeply he's dug into the assassinations of that era. Most of this show we'll be listening to a speech in which he identifies the four crucial assassinations as John F. Kennedy, Martin Luther King, Robert Kennedy, and Malcolm X. His talk is centered around just one of them, since he's speaking about his new book, JFK and the Unspeakable. It's a 90-minute speech, so we'll also find time to listen to some other relevant speeches of the great Martin Luther King, from John F. Kennedy, and a word from Bill Hicks, with a snippet of history as far back as 1914. Now you get my respect if you can spot the parallel with 1914 coming before you hear it. Now here's Jim Douglas's talk, which he gave in Seattle in 2008.
I first heard the name James Douglas in 1973, in the summer of 1973. At that time, I happened to spend a brief while with the Trappists of St. Joseph's Monastery in Spencer, Massachusetts. And I had a number of conversations, particularly with one of the monks, whose name was Brother Ansel Gorman, a very wonderful monk from Brooklyn, New York. In the course of our conversations, he said, "You know, there's a book you would really like, and there's a writer you really should get to know. His name is James Douglas, and he's written this book called Resistance and Contemplation." And shortly thereafter, I got a copy of the book. And it wasn't long after that when I got a hold of the Nonviolent Cross. I met Jim Douglas for the first time in 1974 at a Fellowship of Reconciliation conference in Wisconsin, and then got to know Jim as a good friend in the course of the Anti-Trident work here. As everyone here is aware, Jim has a new book, very, very powerful new book, entitled JFK and the Unspeakable. It has been profoundly well received. The Reverend Doctor of Law, Richard Falk from Princeton University, has said that it is a book that every thinking American citizen needs to read. And the response that I think is even more impressive is that from Daniel Ellsberg, who released the Pentagon Papers in the early 70s. Ellsberg said that JFK and the Unspeakable is the first book he has ever encountered on the Kennedy assassination that has moved him at this very late date to come out for a new criminal investigation in the matter of John F. Kennedy's death. So with that said, please welcome our friend and brother, Jim Douglas.
Thank you, Joe Martin. Maybe I should say something first about getting involved in this journey, which wasn't initially from John Kennedy's assassination. It was from Dr. Martin Luther King's. It was really a story of baptism into nonviolence from Dr. King and from students that I met in a class we had at the University of Hawaii in Honolulu in 1968, where I was teaching a course on the theology of peace. And when King was murdered, several of those students formed a group they called the Hawaii Resistance. They burned their draft cards. Several members of the Hawaii Resistance went to jail for 6 months, another for 2 years. Some went into exile in Sweden and in Canada. And I joined them and was involved in a blockade of a troop convoy of National Guard brothers who were on their way to Vietnam, went to jail, and that was, I guess, the beginning of the end of my academic career. So that was a very good moment in my life, thanks to the giving of life by Martin Luther King. But it also made nonviolence much more than a subject of discussion in our classes. It made it a way of life and a way into deeper and deeper questions, one of which was why Martin Luther King was assassinated. And it took a good while to begin to really to catch up to that question, especially through the wrongful death lawsuit initiated by Coretta Scott King and her family in November, December 1999 in a trial that took place in Memphis, only a few blocks from the Lorraine Motel where he had been killed. I attended every day, every session of that trial for 3 weeks and heard the 70 witnesses describe a plot against King that included CIA and FBI and Army Special Forces, sniper team, members of the Memphis police, mafia intermediaries, and the man who was in the courtroom who had confessed to a role in the trial, a bar and grill owner named Lloyd Jowers. When the jury came back with their verdict, a jury of 6 black and 6 white citizens, they said that Dr. King had been assassinated indeed by a conspiracy that included, and they said this specifically, government agencies. There was a woman next to me in the courtroom who was from a reporter from a Lisbon daily journal. I guess it was the biggest newspaper in Lisbon, who had sent her to the U.S. to cover this trial. And she said to me at one point in the middle of the trial, "You know, Americans say that the O.J. Simpson trial is the trial of the century, and some others say that President Clinton's trial is the trial of the century." She said, "This is the trial of the century, and who's here? You, a writer of books, and me, a reporter from Portugal." And she looked around, and the courtroom was mostly empty, maybe a dozen other people there other than the participants. So that's another side of the question of the assassination of not only Martin Luther King, but also of Malcolm X, of John F. Kennedy, and Robert Kennedy, the four that I see really as one in terms of it being the same story told 4 times over, a story of turning. Each of them turned in a deep sense toward justice and peace. Each of them turned at great risk, and each of them suffered the same kinds of consequences. Tonight, I'm only talking about John Kennedy, but it's a story that continues after John Kennedy because of what went down in that one. That's the first of these four. And it's an experiment in truth to understand his assassination. It's also an experiment in truth to continue moving into it, moving into the question more deeply. So after JFK, then in 65, there's Malcolm, then in 68, there are the other two, Martin and RFK. It's a journey into what Thomas Merton called the unspeakable. And that's why I think we need a spiritual guide. And the one that has helped me to go into the darkness of this question is Thomas Merton. I want to say a little bit about him first. As you know, he was the greatest spiritual writer perhaps of that time. And he saw its Cold War perils with a depth of insight that no one else seemed to have. From the Abbey of Gethsemane in the hills of Kentucky, Thomas Merton raised critical questions about President Kennedy that can help us see what was going on in Washington in the months leading up to Kennedy's assassination. In a letter Thomas Merton wrote to a friend in January 1962, 1 year into Kennedy's presidency, the monk summed up the president in a negative yet prophetic way. This is what he wrote. "I have little confidence in Kennedy. I think he cannot fully measure up to the magnitude of his task and lacks creative imagination and a deeper kind of sensitivity that is needed. Too much the time and life mentality, than which I can imagine nothing further in reality from, say, Lincoln. What is needed is really not shrewdness or craft, but what politicians don't have: depth, humanity, and a certain totality of self-forgetfulness and compassion, not just for individuals, but for humanity as a whole, a deeper kind of dedication. Maybe Kennedy will break through into that someday by miracle, but such people are before long marked out for assassination." As Thomas Merton observed, John F. Kennedy was no saint, nor was he initially up to his overwhelming task as president. He failed to stop the CIA's plan to invade the Bay of Pigs, and he began to be drawn into the Vietnam War. However, as Merton was praying for him to do, Kennedy was turning toward a deeper, more compassionate, more universal humanity. Shuva, turning, the biblical word for repentance, is the explanation for Kennedy's short-lived, contradictory journey toward peace. He was turning from what would have been the worst violence in history in the Cuban Missile Crisis toward a new, more peaceful humanity in his and our lives. Because he broke through by miracle to such a change, Kennedy was marked out for assassination. He had placed himself in deadly conflict with the unspeakable. The unspeakable is a term Thomas Merton coined at the heart of the 60s after JFK's assassination, in the midst of the escalating Vietnam War, the nuclear arms race, and the further assassinations of Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy. In each of those soul-shaking events, Merton sensed an evil whose depth and deceit seemed to go beyond the capacity of words to describe. "One of the awful facts of our age," Merton wrote in 1965, "is the evidence that the world is stricken indeed, stricken to the very core of its being by the presence of the unspeakable." Thomas Merton's sense of what John Kennedy needed to break through to, and the fatal consequences if he did so, call to mind a scene early in Kennedy's presidency. JFK had just met with Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev in Vienna. Late at night, on the June 5, 1961 plane flight back to Washington, the weary president asked his secretary, Evelyn Lincoln, if she would please file the documents he had been working on. As she started to clear the table in the plane, Evelyn Lincoln noticed a little slip of paper that had fallen on the floor. On it were two lines in Kennedy's handwriting, a favorite saying of his from Abraham Lincoln. I know there is a God, and I see a storm coming. If he has a place for me, I believe that I am ready. The summit meeting with Khrushchev had deeply disturbed Kennedy. The American president thought the Soviet chairman had shown no real concern about nuclear war and that he was unwilling to compromise, making nuclear war far more likely. Thus, Kennedy saw a storm coming. While reflecting that night on such a terrifying storm, Kennedy, echoing Lincoln, had written first to himself, I know there is a God. Thomas Merton, in his initial assessment of Kennedy, had doubted if JFK, by falling short of Lincoln's character, was capable of weathering a storm. However, Kennedy, continuing Lincoln's saying, prayed and hoped that he was. If God has a place for me, I believe that I am ready. Merton saw that if Kennedy became what he needed to be, he would be marked out for assassination. How clearly did Kennedy see the dangers to himself if he met the coming storm faithfully? One summer weekend in 1962, while out sailing with friends, President Kennedy was asked what he thought of 7 Days in May, a best-selling novel that described a military takeover in the United States. JFK said he would read the book. He did so that night. The next day, Kennedy discussed with his friends the possibility of their seeing such a coup in the U.S. These words were spoken by him after the Bay of Pigs and before the Cuban Missile Crisis. He said, it's possible for a military coup. It could happen in this country, but the conditions would have to be just right. If, for example, the country had a young president and he had a Bay of Pigs, there would be a certain uneasiness. Maybe the military would do a little criticizing behind his back. But this would be written off as the usual military dissatisfaction with civilian control. Then if there were another Bay of Pigs, the reaction of the country would be, is he too young and inexperienced? The military would almost feel that it was their patriotic obligation to stand ready to preserve the integrity of the nation. And only God knows just what segment of democracy they would be defending if they overthrew the elected establishment. Pausing a moment, he went on, then, if there were a third Bay of Pigs, it could happen. Waiting again until his listeners absorbed his meaning, he concluded with an old Navy phrase, but it won't happen on my watch. As we know, the young President John Kennedy did have a Bay of Pigs. The president bitterly disappointed the CIA and the military by deciding to accept defeat at the Bay of Pigs rather than escalate the battle. Kennedy realized after the fact that he had been drawn into a CIA scenario whose authors assumed he would be forced by circumstances to drop his advance restrictions against the use of U.S. combat forces. The CIA tried to trap Kennedy, as revealed by documents declassified 40 years later. Contrary to what the CIA told the president, they never expected the Cuban people to support the Cuban exiles led by CIA agents who invaded the Bay of Pigs. As news analyst Daniel Shore commented, the CIA's assumption was that President Kennedy, who had emphatically banned direct American involvement, would be forced by public opinion to come to the aid of the returning patriots. American forces, probably Marines, would come in to expand the beachhead. But as Kennedy said to two of his closest friends, they couldn't believe that a new president like me wouldn't panic and try to save his own face by sending in American troops. Well, they had me figured all wrong. John Kennedy reacted strongly to the CIA's pleading when the enormity of the Bay of Pigs disaster came home to him. He said he wanted to splinter the CIA in 1,000 pieces and scatter it to the winds. In his own terms, John Kennedy did have a second Bay of Pigs. The president alienated the CIA and the military a second time by his decisions during the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kennedy secretly taped the White House meetings during the crisis. Their published transcripts, which we have today, reveal how isolated the president was in choosing to blockade further Soviet missile shipments rather than bomb and invade Cuba. Nowhere does he stand more alone against the pressures for a sudden, massive airstrike than in his October 19, 1962 meeting with the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In this encounter, the chief's disdain for their young commander-in-chief is summed up by Air Force Chief of Staff General Curtis LeMay when he says, "This blockade and political action is almost as bad as the appeasement of Hitler at Munich. I think that a blockade and political talk would be considered by a lot of our friends and neutrals as being a pretty weak response to this. And I'm sure a lot of our own citizens would feel that way too. You're in a pretty bad fix, Mr. President." President Kennedy responds, "What did you say?" LeMay, "You're in a pretty bad fix." President Kennedy, with a mocking laugh, "You're in with me." As the meeting draws to a close, Kennedy rejects totally the Joint Chief's arguments for a quick, massive attack on Cuba. The president then leaves the room, but the tape keeps on recording. Two or three of the generals remain. And one says to LeMay, "You pulled the rug right out from under him, goddamn." LeMay, with a chuckle, "Jesus Christ, what the hell do you mean?" Other general, "He finally got around to the word escalation. That's the only goddamn thing that's in the whole trick. Go in and get every goddamn one of the missiles. Escalation, that's it. Somebody's got to keep them from doing the goddamn thing piecemeal. That's our problem." The White House tapes show Kennedy questioning and resisting the mounting pressure to bomb Cuba coming from both the Joint Chiefs and the Executive Committee of the National Security Council. As in the case of the Bay of Pigs, the Cuban Missile Crisis revealed the truth that President Kennedy's greatest conflict was not with any communist enemy. It was with his own national security state. Thomas Merton, in a letter that anticipated the Cuban Missile Crisis, stated the need for a transformation if humankind were to survive such a hot climax to the Cold War. Merton said, "The policy of the nation is more or less frankly oriented toward a war of extermination. Step by step, we come closer to it because the country commits itself more and more to policies which, but for a miracle, will make it inevitable." The two men most responsible for the Cuban Missile Crisis, John Kennedy and Nikita Khrushchev, seemed locked in a hopeless ideological conflict that confirmed Merton's dire analysis. The U.S. and Soviet leaders were following policies which, but for a miracle, would make inevitable a war of extermination. Yet, as we have since learned, Kennedy and Khrushchev, like Thomas Merton, were writing their own desperate but somehow hopeful Cold War letters, secretly, to
to each other, even as they moved step by step toward a Cold War climax that would almost take the world over the edge with them, they were at the same time for over a year smuggling confidential letters back and forth that recognized each other's humanity and hoped for a solution. The first letter from Khrushchev to Kennedy was wrapped up in a newspaper. It was taken by a KGB agent to Kennedy's press secretary, Pierre Salinger, who gave him this newspaper for the president. Salinger said, "The president needs another newspaper." The man said, "Check inside." Inside was this 27-page letter from Khrushchev to Kennedy that had not been seen by Khrushchev's advisors and was not seen by Kennedy's advisors. And in the center of that letter, Nikita Khrushchev, the atheist, proposed to John F. Kennedy as a symbol of their situation and our global situation, Noah's Ark. And he said to Kennedy in his letter, a very beautiful letter that began with images of the Black Sea where Khrushchev was writing, and he said, "You know, we're on Noah's Ark. We're all on Noah's Ark. And let's not argue about who are the clean and who are the unclean on the Ark. We're all on the Ark in the nuclear age." Kennedy, in his response from Hyannisport, talking about the beauties of that home of his, said, "Yes, that's the symbol of both of us and of all of us, Noah's Ark." They were enemies who, in the midst of the deepening turmoil, were learning something approaching trust in each other. Thus it came to pass that in the most decisive hour of the Cuban Missile Crisis, when both sides were falling into darkness, it was the moment at which the U-2 spy plane was shot down by Soviet surface-to-air missile, a point at which everyone around Kennedy, with the exception of his brother Robert, were pushing. Now there had to be retaliation. There had to be a taking out of the Soviet missiles before they could get the nuclear warheads on them. In fact, they already had them on them. If the attack had been made, that would have been total nuclear war at that moment. So thus it came to pass that at that moment, when they were falling into darkness, Nikita Khrushchev in Moscow turned to his foreign minister, who was Andrei Gromyko, and said something totally shocking. Khrushchev said, "We have to let Kennedy know that we want to help him." As Khrushchev's son Sergei describes that surprising moment, his father hesitated to use the word help in response to John Kennedy's plea for precisely that. When Khrushchev did say the word aloud, it forced him to ask himself, did he really want to help his enemy, Kennedy? After a short silence inspired by the sense of his word help, Khrushchev repeated it to a wondering Gromyko, "Yes, help. We now have a common cause to save the world from those pushing us toward war." In that grace-filled moment, Nikita Khrushchev, his new partner, John Kennedy, and the world with them went from darkness to dawn. What especially moved Khrushchev to help Kennedy by withdrawing the Soviet missiles from Cuba was Ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin's description of his secret meeting with Robert Kennedy. The president's brother was exhausted. Dobrynin could see from Robert Kennedy's eyes that he hadn't slept for days. RFK told him the president didn't know how to resolve the situation. The military is putting great pressure on him, insisting on military actions against Cuba, and the president is in a very difficult position. Even if he doesn't want or desire a war, something irreversible could occur against his will. That is why the president is asking for help to solve this problem. In his memoirs, Khrushchev reported a further chilling sentence from Robert Kennedy's appeal to Dobrynin. If the situation continues much longer, the president is not sure that the military will not overthrow him and seize power. Sergei has described his father's thoughts when he read Dobrynin's report relaying the Kennedy's plea. The president was calling for help. That was how father interpreted Robert Kennedy's talk with our ambassador. The tone of the conversation was evidence of the fact that to delay could be fatal. The temperature in the Washington boiler had apparently reached a dangerous point and was about to explode. Half a world apart, in radical ideological conflict, both Kennedy in his call for help and Khrushchev in his response had recognized their interdependence with each other and the world. They suddenly joined hands. When Khrushchev withdrew his Soviet missiles from Cuba, and Kennedy in turn pledged not to invade Cuba and secretly promised to withdraw U.S. missiles from Turkey, neither side won in the missile crisis. In fact, each leader made vital concessions to his Cold War opponent that dismayed the zealots in his own camp. Their willingness to turn toward peace at a critical point in history was the kind of miracle Thomas Merton was praying for. It brought profound consequences to both the world and themselves. John Kennedy's next Bay of Pigs, his next critical conflict with his military leaders and the CIA, was his American University address. Saturday Review editor Norman Cousins summed up the significance of this remarkable speech. At American University, on June 10, 1963, President Kennedy proposed an end to the Cold War. The Cold Warrior John F. Kennedy was turning, in the root biblical sense of the word turning, shuva in the Hebrew scriptures, metanoia in the Greek, repentance in English. In the Cuban Missile Crisis, John Kennedy, as President of the United States, had begun to turn away to repent from his own complicity with the worst sin of his national security state, its willingness to destroy the world in order to save it from communism. Yet in the months following the missile crisis, Kennedy and Khrushchev seemed unable to seize the moment. They agreed that a ban on nuclear testing was a critical next step away from the brink, but they could not agree on how many on-site inspections were needed by each side to verify compliance with the treaty. When they became deadlocked, Khrushchev refused to budge. He said the next move was up to Kennedy. Kennedy accepted Khrushchev's challenge. His American University address broke the deadlock by transforming the context. By the empathy he expressed toward the Russian perspective, Kennedy created a bridge to Khrushchev. He began his speech by describing in detail the enormous suffering and death and overwhelming disaster that the Soviets had experienced in the Second World War beyond anything that any other people had experienced. And then he said that would be nothing compared to what we would all experience, especially the people of those two nations, through a nuclear exchange. The two Cold War leaders would then have 5.5 months left after this speech to make peace before JFK's murder. At the same time as Kennedy's speech reached out to Khrushchev, it opened a still wider chasm between the president and his own military and intelligence advisors. To the Pentagon and the CIA, the president's words of peace at American University seemed to put him on the enemy's side. On June 10, 1963, President Kennedy introduced the subject of his speech to the graduating class at American University as the most important topic on earth, world peace. "What kind of peace do I mean?" he asked. "What kind of peace do we seek?" He answered, "Not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war." Kennedy's rejection of a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war was an act of resistance to what President Eisenhower had identified in his farewell address as the military-industrial complex. What Eisenhower, in the final hours of his presidency, revealed as the greatest threat to our democracy, Kennedy, in the midst of his presidency, chose to resist. The military-industrial complex was totally dependent on a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. That Pax Americana, policed by the Pentagon, was considered the system's indispensable, hugely profitable means of containing and defeating communism. At great risk, Kennedy was rejecting the foundation of the Cold War system. He went on to unilaterally pledge never to test a nuclear weapon in the atmosphere again unless an opponent did. He said that he would do that as a way to extend trust toward the other side and to initiate the process for a nuclear test ban treaty. He pledged to go to send negotiators to the heartland, to the capital of the other side, the Soviet Union, to negotiate a treaty with Nikita Khrushchev to begin the process of ending the Cold War. John Kennedy's strategy of peace penetrated the Soviet government's defenses far more effectively than any missile could have done. The Soviet press, which was accustomed to censoring U.S. government documents, published the entire speech all across the country. The entire speech. Soviet radio stations broadcast and rebroadcast the speech to the Soviet people. In response to Kennedy's turn toward peace, the Soviet government even stopped jamming all Western broadcasts into their country. Nikita Khrushchev was deeply moved by what Kennedy had said. He told test ban negotiator Averell Harriman that Kennedy had given the greatest speech by any American president since Roosevelt. Khrushchev responded by proposing to Kennedy that they now considered a limited test ban encompassing the atmosphere, outer space, and water so that the disputed question of inspections would no longer arise. Kennedy's speech was received less favorably in his own country. The New York Times reported his government's skepticism. Generally, there was not much optimism in official Washington that the president's conciliation address at American University would produce agreement on a test ban treaty or anything else. In contrast to the Soviet media that were electrified by the speech, U.S. media ignored or downplayed it, and have to this very day.
Let it not be said that this media ignored the speech. It's a beautiful work of speechmanship, made all the more beautiful by the fact that Kennedy obviously meant what he said in terms of making world peace, because he dedicated the rest of his life, 5.5 months more, to doing exactly that against a considerable opposition. The contrast with modern politics, so-called, could hardly be more extreme, both in terms of the discourse itself. You know all about John Taylor Gatto's theses on dumbing down. I think this presidential speech, contrasted to modern 30-second soundbites, is pretty revealing. Mostly, of course, the sincerity of the people engaged in it. I learned from the Wall Street Journal last week that the president of change, Obama, has what is set to be a $60 billion arms deal to Saudi Arabia, that bastion of freedom and democracy in the Middle East. So, this is the American University speech from Kennedy on the 10th of June 1963, and the whole speech, should you choose to give it a listen, is available from this show's website, unwelcomeguests.net/517.
There are few earthly things more beautiful than a university, wrote John Masefield in his tribute to English universities. and his words are equally true today. He did not refer to towers or to campuses. He admired the splendid beauty of a university because it was, he said, a place where those who hate ignorance may strive to know, where those who perceive truth may strive to make others see. I have therefore chosen this time and place to discuss a topic on which ignorance too often abounds and the truth too rarely perceived, and that is the most important topic on earth, peace. What kind of a peace do I mean, and what kind of a peace do we seek? Not a Pax Americana enforced on the world by American weapons of war. Not the peace of the grave or the security of the slave. I am talking about genuine peace, the kind of peace that makes life on earth worth living, the kind that enables men and nations to grow and to hope and build a better life for their children. Not merely peace for Americans, but peace for all men and women. Not merely peace in our time, but peace in all time. I speak of peace because of the new face of war. Total war makes no sense in an age where great powers can maintain large and relatively invulnerable nuclear forces and refuse to surrender without resort to those forces. It makes no sense in an age where a single nuclear weapon contains almost 10 times the explosive force delivered by all the Allied air forces in the Second World War. It makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe and to generations yet unborn. Today, the expenditure of billions of dollars every year on weapons acquired for the purpose of making sure we never need them is essential to the keeping of peace. But surely the acquisition of such idle stockpiles, which can only destroy and never create, is not the only, much less the most efficient, means of assuring peace. I speak of peace, therefore, as the necessary rational end of rational men. I realize the pursuit of peace is not as dramatic as the pursuit of war, and frequently the words of the pursuers fall on deaf ears, but we have no more urgent task. Some say that it is useless to speak of peace or world law or world disarmament, and that it will be useless until the leaders of the Soviet Union adopt a more enlightened attitude. I hope they do. I believe we can help them do it. But I also believe that we must re-examine our own attitudes as individuals and as a nation. For our attitude is as essential as theirs. And every graduate of this school, every thoughtful citizen who despairs of war and wishes to bring peace, should begin by looking inward, by examining his own attitude towards the possibilities of peace, towards the Soviet Union, towards the course of the Cold War, and towards freedom and peace here at home. First, examine our attitude towards peace itself. Too many of us think it is impossible. Too many think it is unreal. But that is a dangerous, defeatist belief. It leads to the conclusion that war is inevitable, that mankind is doomed, that we are gripped by forces we cannot control. We need not accept that view. Our problems are man-made. Therefore, they can be solved by man, and man can be as big as he wants. No problem of human destiny is beyond human beings. Man's reason and spirit have often solved the seemingly unsolvable, and we believe they can do it again. I am not referring to the absolute, infinite concept of universal peace and goodwill, of which some fantasies and fanatics dream. I do not deny the value of hopes and dreams, but we merely invite discouragement and incredulity by making that our only and immediate goal. Let us focus instead on a more practical, more attainable peace, based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution in human institutions, on a series of concrete actions and effective agreements, which are in the interests of all concerned. There is no single simple key to this peace, no grand or magic formula to be adopted by one or two powers. Genuine peace must be the product of many nations, the sum of many acts. It must be dynamic, not static, changing to meet the challenge of each new generation. For peace is a process, a way of solving problems. With such a peace, there will still be quarrels and conflicting interests, as there are within families and nations. World peace, like community peace, does not require that each man love his neighbor. It requires only that they live together in mutual tolerance, submitting their disputes to a just and peaceful settlement. And history teaches us that enmities between nations, as between individuals, do not last forever. However fixed our likes and dislikes may seem, the tide of time and events will often bring surprising changes in the relations between nations and neighbors. So let us persevere. Peace need not be impractical, and war need not be inevitable. By defining our goal more clearly, by making it seem more manageable and less remote, we can help all people to see it, to draw hope from it, and to move irresistibly towards it. And second, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Soviet Union. It is discouraging to think that their leaders may actually believe what their propagandists write. It is discouraging to read a recent authoritative Soviet text on military strategy and find on page after page wholly baseless and incredible claims, such as the allegation that American imperialist circles are preparing to unleash different types of war, that there is a very real threat of a preventative war being unleashed by American imperialists against the Soviet Union, and that the political aims, and I quote, of the American imperialists are to enslave economically and politically the European and other capitalist countries and to achieve world domination by means of aggressive war, unquote. Truly, as it was written long ago, the wicked flee when no man pursueth. Yet it is sad to read these Soviet statements to realize the extent of the gulf between us. But it is also a warning to the American people not to fall into the same trap as the Soviets, not to see only a distorted and desperate view of the other side, not to see conflict as inevitable, accommodation as impossible, and communication as nothing more than an exchange of threats. No government or social system is so evil that its people must be considered as lacking in virtue. As Americans, we find communism profoundly repugnant as a negation of personal freedom and dignity. But we can still hail the Russian people for their many achievements in science and space, in economic and industrial growth, in culture, in acts of courage. Among the many traits the peoples of our two countries have in common, none is stronger than our mutual abhorrence of war. Almost unique, among the major world powers, we have never been at war with each other. And no nation in the history of battle ever suffered more than the Soviet Union in the Second World War. At least 20 million lost their lives. Countless millions of homes and families were burned or sacked. A third of the nation's territory, including two-thirds of its industrial base, was turned into a wasteland, a loss equivalent to the destruction of this country east of Chicago. Today, should total war ever break out again, no matter how, our two countries will be the primary target. It is an ironic but accurate fact that the two strongest powers are the two in the most danger of devastation. All we have built, all we have worked for, would be destroyed in the first 24 hours. And even in the Cold War, which brings burdens and dangers to so many countries, including this nation's closest allies, our two countries bear the heaviest burdens. For we are both devoting massive sums of money to weapons that could be better devoted to combat ignorance, poverty, and disease. We are both caught up in a vicious and dangerous cycle, with suspicion on one side breeding suspicion on the other, and new weapons begetting counterweapons. In short, both the United States and its allies, and the Soviet Union and its allies, have a mutually deep interest in a just and genuine peace and in halting the arms race. Agreements to this end are in the interests of the Soviet Union as well as ours, and even the most hostile nations can be relied upon to accept and keep those treaty obligations, and only those treaty obligations, which are in their own interest. So let us not be blind to our differences, but let us also direct attention to our common interests and the means by which those differences can be resolved. And if we cannot end now our differences, at least we can help make the world safe for diversity. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal. Third, let us re-examine our attitude towards the Cold War, remembering we're not engaged in a debate, seeking to pile up debating points. We are not here distributing blame or pointing the finger of judgment. We must deal with the world as it is, and not as it might have been, had the history of the last 18 years been different.
I hope you found those words of Kennedy's as inspiring as I did. Is it just me, or do you never hear words like this in the corporate media either? Is there anybody in the public eye who says mankind made the money system, mankind can create a better money system, mankind can be as big as he wants to be? This nowadays only comes up in adverts when everybody knows this is rubbish and it's just something to say to sell products. What about political leaders suggesting that before we condemn our adversaries, we examine our own attitudes? President Kennedy speaks to my heart, and underneath the superficiality of modern life, I believe that people know what is going on, that people know that they're being lied to massively. If we accept their rhetoric that perpetual war is necessary for perpetual peace, Kennedy states that we are doomed without a turning. By my analysis, reliance on money and markets and self-interest is a kind of war, and it's going on all around us, and people develop a kind of immunity to it. They normalize it. And what I'm suggesting is that as the destruction which it causes becomes clearer and clearer, that there will be a massive turning away, a repentance. But that's a topic for another show. So, not to get sidetracked, let's get back to Kennedy's next contretemps with the security state.
For the first time, Americans had less opportunity to read and hear the president's words than did the Russian people. A turnaround was occurring in the world on different levels. Whereas nuclear disarmament had suddenly become feasible, Kennedy's position in his own government had become precarious. As Thomas Merton had hoped and prayed, but thought unlikely, John Kennedy was turning much faster than was safe for a Cold War leader. President Kennedy's next critical conflict with his national security state, propelling him toward the coup d'etat he saw as possible, was the partial nuclear test ban treaty that he signed with Nikita Khrushchev on July 25, 1963, 6 weeks after the American University address. Kennedy was fiercely determined, but not optimistic, that the test ban treaty be ratified by the defense-conscious Senate. In early August, he told his advisors that getting Senate ratification of the agreement at that height of the Cold War would be almost in the nature of a miracle. He said if a Senate vote were held right then, it would fall far short of the necessary two-thirds. Kennedy initiated a whirlwind public education campaign on the treaty, coordinated by Saturday Review editor Norman Cousins, who directed a committee of peace activists. By the end of August, the tide of congressional mail had gone from 15-1 against the test ban to 3-2 against. In the meantime, the president and his committee of activists were bucking the military-industrial complex, which had become alarmed at Kennedy's sudden turn toward peace and his alliance with peace activists in support of the test ban. The August 5, 1963 U.S. News and World Report carried a major article headlined, "Is U.S. giving up in the arms race?" The article cited many authorities in the military establishment who now are silenced as thinking that the Kennedy administration's new strategy adds up to a type of intentional and one-sided disarmament. The president's peacemaking had by now moved beyond any effective military control. In the test ban talks, the military weren't in the loop. Kennedy made a very quick end run around them to negotiate the treaty. Kennedy pointed out to Cousins that he and Khrushchev now had more in common with each other than either had with his own military establishment. He said, "You know, one of the ironic things about this entire situation is that Mr. Khrushchev and I occupy approximately the same political positions inside our governments. He would like to prevent a nuclear war, but is under severe pressures from his hardline crowd, which interprets every move in that direction as appeasement. I've got similar problems."
Okay, it's historical retrospective time. I'm going to explore a historical parallel. I'm taking you back 50 years. So after the music, we're going to have an example of a much hotter war in which a similar turning occurred, not this time by two men, but by thousands of men. So have a think during the music as to what that parallel could be. To give you a clue, I'll remind you of that classic anti-war slogan, "A bayonet is a weapon with a worker at each end."
Send